Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner, it's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
With David Canfield.
Hi.
And Rebecca Ford.
Hi.
We have resumed all on the same continent again. Cannes is over. We will have lots to talk about. Richard and Rebecca have done excellent writing about all of it. Later in this episode, we're going to kick off our month of Pride flashbacks with 1932's Shanghai Express, starring Marlene Dietrich. But before we get to any of that, we kind of wanted to double back to last week's episode because we got so much great listener feedback about degendering acting awards. We kind of talked about some ideas last week and more just about the urgency of the push to make room for non-binary performers in these awards. But a lot of you wrote in with really great ideas. I think other people have talked about it in other media outlets as well. David, having done the reporting on this, did any of our wonderful listeners write in with something that felt like the magic bullet that's going to solve this?
Magic bullet. Hard to say. We've talked a little bit about what we've seen come in and the surprising, I don't want to say consensus, but most frequent suggestion was this idea of adapted and original performance, which essentially separates fictional characters, performances of fictional characters, and performances of real life figures, which on one hand I definitely get, especially since there's something exciting about the fact that because the Oscars can get so clogged up with biopic performances, having a space for more original creations, which are usually a part of more original movies, giving them the space to really shine is exciting and would be something very different for the Oscars. But we can get into why that might be a little complicated in its own way. But yeah, there were a lot of different kinds of suggestions. And I think overall it speaks to that sentiment that you mentioned, Katie, that Liv Hugh said to me of reinvent it, because there really is so much you can do once you allow yourself to think about what is possible beyond what has been done before.
The adapted thing is interesting. It made me kind of do a little thought experiment about like, okay, so what are some recent years where that would have been a huge factor? So like in 2014, Michael Keaton was the only Best Actor nominee who wasn't playing a real person.
Wow.
He was in Birdman, because otherwise you had Redmayne as Stephen Hawking, Steve Carell as John DuPont, Foxcatcher, Bradley Cooper, an American Sniper, and Benedict Cumberbatch, who the inventor of computers. Mm-hmm. Today we call them that. So it's like, okay, so I guess Keaton just wins and then there are four other nominees there. Or does DiCaprio... Oh, no, I guess he was real. Jordan Belfort was real. So it would have to be Bruce Dern for Nebraska the previous year. But the year before that, Jean Valjean, Hugh Jackman could have won. He wasn't real, as far as I know, nor was Bradley Cooper in Silver Linings. So that change would greatly affect the lead acting categories, which would be fascinating. And it's kind of a fun, maybe that's better for this head Oscar buzz, but like it would affect basically the last 25 plus years of Oscars in a significant way.
It does feel like in the last few years, those sort of historical biopics haven't been as in trend or successful as they, were a few years ago. But with this premise, does a character like the Fablemans, is a real person?
Yeah, or, this okay. is where it gets so complicated.
It's not because adapted and original screenplay is based on what does it come from an original work. But this is like, is this a real person? Right? I think that's where my brain is kind of stumbling over the difference when it comes to acting versus
the adaptation screenplay. Is from someone's real life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We didn't really celebrate enough how low on biopics this past. Like, I'm looking at the best actor and best actress. It was really Austin Butler and Ana de Armas as real people. And then, you know, you can get Lydia Tarr in there. Lydia Tarr would blow up this entire distinction because no one could agree on whether she's real or not. But yeah, we had a lot more fictional people. So it would really fluctuate year to year. But would we get more biopics? If there's a whole category for biopic performances, basically, does that just flood the market even more?
Oh God, I don't want to go back to that.
In the actress category, as it stands, like it's much rarer of late for someone to win for playing a real person. I mean, it certainly has happened with Chastain and Zellweger and Coleman. Queen Anne was a real person. Yeah. No one knows what she sounded like, but you have a lot more like Brie Larson, Emma Stone, Julianne Moore. I don't think Alice was real. I don't think Blue Jasmine was a real person. You know, so like that would maybe they would start making more biopics about women, which would in general be good for that sort of parody because we have a lot of great man movies and fewer, for women.
Yeah,
I think one of the questions of this is if you're talking about an adapted performance, like if you look at say, you know, The Great Gatsby, like, is Nick Carraway, say, falling into the category of an adapted performance or an original performance? Because in a way, it's something that you are there's more material to draw from there with that than there is even with something like The Fabelmans, because that's, you know, an original screenplay. It is absolutely, you know, a memoir. But those characters don't have any real, they don't exist in any pop culture or any text or material. So that's where I get tripped up is how do you sort of differentiate where is the line between the two categories? Because there's a lot of ways to define an actor drawing on, you know, past interpretations, making something their own versus creating something entirely new.
Yeah. Is Jackson Maine in A Star Is Born an original or an adapted performance? I don't know.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
It does feel like this would create a lot of opportunity for category fraud, which I think none of us are very excited
I mean, we've
about.
Already got plenty of it, though.
The next phase.
No, he's based on a guy I knew, so it counts. It counts.
Even, you know, I talked to Celine Song this week about Past Lives, which is very clearly based on her own life. But even she's like, this is an interpretation of my life. There's just a lot of room for, I don't know, conversation there about what is... I don't know. It seems really tricky.
You do find a lot of directors, especially, you know, in that sort of Roma category of black and white childhood memoirs that we've seen a lot of lately. There can be a reluctance to describe how much of it is real, which characters specifically are real, and it does get really fuzzy. Again, because these are directors working off of their own material, and they're giving actors characters to play, and, you know, we've all interviewed actors who've played these parts, and a lot of times they'll say, yeah, I didn't really talk that much about X's father. I just sort of went with what was on the page. And so that would imply that they're creating an original character when in fact it's someone who, you know, is based on someone who lived in real life and who is being shaped by a director in some way who knew him or her.
So there's another idea that came from Kevin that I thought was really intriguing, kind of like the most other specific idea, which is basically to crib off of the Emmys and have an outstanding guest appearance performance, but like best featured performance. So saying this would be performances like Judi Dench in Shakespeare in Love and Judd Hirsch in The Fabelmans. So adding that and then also a breakthrough performance category, which we've seen at the Indie Spirits and a few other smaller awards. So, you know, Kevin writes, my genderless acting Oscar categories would be lead performance, supporting performance, featured performance, breakthrough performance. I think there's a fuzziness there as with the adapted versus original performances, but I'm kind of like this idea. Like, I don't know how many Judi Dench and Judd Hirsch level performances you get in a given year, and that category could be very odd for a while, but I thought there was potential there.
Yeah, the rubric would be screen time, and then you'd have to say, well, okay, but there have been lead performances. I guess, you know, Silence of the Lambs is a famous one where Hopkins is not actually in that much of the movie, but he won Best Actor. But like, I think they should send up that test balloon this year so Patti LuPone can definitely win an Oscar for featured performance in Beau Is Afraid. Because she's, yeah, she is supporting, but like, she's really in one scene where she has a monologue. But I think it's a great idea, because how many times have we all said on this podcast, like, oh, I just saw this big movie, so-and-so is great, but I think their part's too small. I don't know if they have enough. You know, I'm thinking like Sheila McCarthy in Women Talking, mm-hmm. you know, people like that who aren't going to get the supporting push because there's someone, quote unquote, above them. But if there was a third option, a third way, mm-hmm. That would be thrilling.
One thing I didn't get into as much when we talked about this last week was, my opinion of the Emmys is that they should just, you know, degender the categories and leave them as is, because they have so many acting categories and so many tiers, because they also have things like short form, and they have, it just goes on and on and on. The Oscars obviously don't have that luxury or that room, but this also does open up the possibility of maybe expanding the definition of what you can honor in a motion picture, what kind of performance. And mm-hmm. I think that these are good examples of expanding the definition without sacrificing the fact that the Oscars do want to be, you know, curated. They don't want to be nominating 100 actors every year. That's a big thing that came up in my reporting, was they're not interested in, you know, expanding the number of nominees. And that's a big concern. So they have to find a way to keep the number of winners the same, if not more, while also keeping that feeling of, you know, exclusivity and feeling special and feeling like the big one. And that's a tough balance to strike, but these are the kinds of awards, of categories, that I think allow them to do that.
So I want to throw out one more that came from Renee, who suggested dividing it by age, noting that we talk about ageism in the industry, and it's time for Hollywood to learn that one age is not preferable to another. Renee throws out basically the age of roles, not the actual ages of the actors, maybe dividing 1 to 19, 20 to 29, 30 to 49, 50 to 59, 60 to 99. That leaves us with, I think, 6 or 5 categories. And then she points out that if a role calls for an actor to age throughout the story, you pick one fitting time period, which I think in many of these biopic stories, you get a wide span of it. I'm not opposed to this idea. I think it would be incredibly complicated, only because often you don't know how old half the people are in a movie. But I think it does point out that there are a lot of different ways to rethink this, if nothing else.
It's cool to see people think outside the box on this, because I feel like that's the one thing we're begging these leadership groups to do. And so it definitely proves that there are ideas. Yeah, I think telling writers you have to write the age of all your characters in your scripts, you know, when they come back from the strike and are writing again, seems like asking a lot of them. And yeah, there's so much. It's so tricky with actors, you know, rightly so, being sensitive about their age in general. But it's a complicated one. But I no idea is a bad idea at this point, right? Like, we just want ideas, I think, to sort of push this forward. So
I don't really want to know how old Joker from Joker is, you know.
he's ageless as well. Yeah. Known.
Is that an adapted performance, Richard?
yeah, exactly. It would be kind of funny, though, to force, because there's a lot of this in Hollywood where it's like, that actor is like 55 and they have a 4-year-old kid. Like, how's that working? And they're like, no, the character's 35. It would sort of force a lot of honesty about that. BAFTA does young performer, right? That's something they do.
They
do Breakthrough.
Who is it? Was it Golden Globes used to do young performer?
It's Critics' Choice does a kid performer.
And Golden Globes used to have like the Star of the Year. Like, that was the Pia Zadora Award that she like bought, basically.
Yeah, I mean, that sort of thing, Breakthrough, however you want to label it, like, I think that could also do something interesting in terms of affecting the balance of, like, the kind of age-old thing of, like, you know, older male performers win Best Actor and younger female performers win Best Actress, and maybe if there was a younger thing that would sort of change that dynamic some in a good way.
It's funny because between Sheila McCarthy, Judd Hirsch, Judi Dench, etc., you could say that featured performance category would look a lot like an older actor category.
Yeah.
It true. Is where they tend to shine because, you know, because there is ageism in Hollywood, and those actors of a certain age who are not Meryl Streep do not tend to have the meatiest roles in films, especially. it's where they get a chance to shine. And so it is the kind of, that is the kind of category that, especially coupled with a breakthrough performance, you could achieve that sort of spread without having specific age ranges for them.
I would really love to for someone to go back through last year's Oscars and figure out like who fits into all of these categories in these given movies. Like, you know, like Harry Shum Jr. probably gets a featured performer for Everything Everywhere, given that movie suite. Like there's interesting potential there. Although then you're combining the lead and supporting categories, so maybe you have fewer people. Someone do the math for us and write us back.
Get your stopwatches out.
Yeah.
Joe Reed, do the math for us.
Yeah, exactly. What you're saying. Yeah, Joe. Yeah. I really do want to keep hearing from people. I don't know if we'll revisit this topic on future episodes, but if you have ideas for this, we will send them to the Academy as best we can. Email us at littlegoldmen@vf.com. Let's keep the conversation going.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
So Richard and Rebecca, you are back from Cannes. I don't know if you've recovered, if you're still eating baguettes on a daily basis, how that process works. But you pulled it together and wrote about the awards that happen on Saturday at the festival and, you know, wrote very to the point, like, did we see a future Oscar contender premiere at this year's Cannes? And I think, as usual, the answer is maybe. But it does seem like there was a lot of good stuff there regardless.
Yeah, we talked, I guess, on Tuesday, right? So I had a couple more days there. For me, one of the bigger, well, obviously Rebecca and I did not see the Palme d'Or winner. I feel like
we're the biggest losers here. Neither of us.
I feel like I gave my bad luck with that to Rebecca by accident.
Thanks a lot, Rebecca.
I'm excited to see that one. It sounds great. But I think the big kind of later breakout, in the second week at the festival was this movie, The Pot au Feu, which is this really like decadently filmed food romance period piece with Juliette Binoche.
I feel that, like, I've seen one of those and it was called Chocolat.
Well, exactly. I hesitate to say, or no, I'm fine saying it's better than Chocolat.
Okay.
it's a lot more subdued than I think the initial reactions were. I saw it the next day and I really liked it, but it's a kind of more muted movie. Tran Anh Hung, who is the director, he won Best Director, which is big for that movie and for him. He's been a Cannes, you know, person for many decades, and so it's exciting to have him come back with this big movie. And I don't know, Stephanie Zakaric, the Time critic, tweeted something about the movie that like really convinced me I had to see it the next day, which is there's a great art house theater in the Boston area called the Coolidge Corner Theater, and she's like, this is the kind of movie that would have played at the Coolidge Corner Theater in 1985 for 6 months. Like, it has that kind of older audience art house, but like really accessible, heartwarming, sad sort of pull to it. And I don't know, I think that could, to use a food joke, I guess, work a treat on the Academy. I don't believe it has US distribution yet, which that will obviously really affect it. I mean, Neon is obviously this is the fourth Palme d'Or winner they've bought before the Palme has been announced.
I saw they tweeted a picture of Michael Jordan like holding up four fingers for his championships. Like, they're really feeling high on that.
Pretty significant for them. Obviously, Parasite, their first big acquisition at Cannes, made a lot of money for them. But I mean, you know, for an international art house. But like, Titan did not do so well. And Triangle of Sadness, I think, did okay given the circumstances. But yeah, so I think that Anatomy of a Fall, the film that Neon bought, the Palme d'Or winner, seems to have a lot of commercial appeal. It's a legal thriller. So I don't know. I think those two that weren't already really on our radar ahead of Cannes feel like the biggest breakouts. I don't know. What am I missing, Rebecca?
No, I think you're right. I mean, I think a lot of people were surprised that Zone of Interest got the second place prize, the Grand Prix. I think a lot of people had assumed it was going to win the Palme, but as we've been saying, you can't. The juries are unpredictable every year. They're different every year. We don't know what they're going to do. But I think someone even asked in the press conference after they asked Ruben Östlund, who was the president. They basically told him they were surprised because everyone was talking about Zone of Interest. And he was like, well, we don't listen to critics is the way to answer that question. But I thought that was a little surprising. I do think, you know, we're going to see an awards push for that. And then it's of note that Monster won, the Coriata won screenplay. I think, you know, we'll probably see that make a run for at least international feature as we get closer to that time of year. But I think that sort of covers the main things. I think it's really smart that Killers of the Flower Moon was not in competition, so we don't have to be talking about why it didn't win anything, you know, because that's an obvious Oscar contender at this point.
How did May December fare? I honestly forgot to look at whether it won any
It didn't
awards.
Win anything.
Is that surprising?
No. You know, I'm a big fan of that film, but with this jury, I'm not that surprised. They really spread the wealth among a lot of the international features. So I don't know, Richard, if you were surprised, but I didn't. I thought maybe actress, but...
Yeah, actress went to the star of the Nuri Bilgis Ceylan movie about dry grasses. So that was a nice kind of surprise, kind of out of left field, because there were so many big stars in movies, you know, and Sandra Hüller is not a huge star in the U.S., obviously, but she's, you know, a big German actress. She was in a huge Cannes movie a few years ago, and Toni Erdmann, she had two big movies this year. So people were kind of saying, well, obviously she has to win, but I don't know. I bet Ruben Östlund does pay a little bit of attention to that scuttlebutt quietly on his lurking Twitter account or something and was like, I did not, unfortunately, see About Dry Grasses. It's kind of hard to sign up for a Ceylan movie at Cannes because they're long and they're very slow and you're often very tired. So I will see it when I have a bit more energy. So that's, you know, but that's a cool win. But it did, you know, that was probably May-December's best shot for Natalie Portman. But I don't think that really means anything for the movie's chances. I think, you know, with a Netflix campaign behind it, if they, I don't know where they're going to slot it, probably, you know, somewhere under Maestro, but maybe there's movies in between those two in terms of their campaign budget. But yeah, I think it's okay that it didn't win. I'm sure that it's disappointing for Todd Haynes and others, but, you know, only a few things can win at this festival.
Yeah. So A24 has Zone of Interest and Neon has Anatomy of a Fall. Are they just now the two distributors who are most invested in these kinds of movies? I mean, Focus had Asteroid City there. There's obviously other studios involved, but it is interesting that Neon is just like staking itself on like, we are the Cannes people. And then A24 will come up once in a while with a big one too. They're really cornering the market there for American distribution.
And they've kind of proven themselves. I mean, with Triangle of Sadness, that was a pretty polarizing movie, and they got it into picture, director, and screenplay.
Yeah.
I would watch out for how far they can take this movie. And me and my friends in the Sandra Hüller fan club are eagerly watching to see what happens with that particular campaign. Although I guess that's a Neon A24 fight. I guess. I don't know how that's going to work. But yeah, they just have proven art house successes in a time when those are vanishingly rare. And especially with Cannes movies, which are always pushing the boundaries and are always a tougher commercial sell. If you can get a movie that premieres there to have some kind of award success, you know, anyone who saw Titan, like, it's just, it was not going to happen on that scale. I don't think France even... It didn't even make France's, it wasn't even France's submission in the end.
Yeah.
But for the most part, you know, the movies that have a chance to succeed here, those are the studios I think that you'd want behind them. If not, I guess a Netflix who just has a massive built-in streaming audience, but that's a completely different dynamic.
I don't think we're that far off from Neon becoming sort of synonymous with a certain kind of cool, the way that A24 is, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The big difference
or if we're not there already.
Yeah. Neon doesn't produce a lot of its own movies, you know? They have. Like, I think Spencer was theirs from the get-go, right? And there are other things. But yeah, I don't know. I think it's interesting. I think Neon really needs to get the sort of financial traction. It's one thing for us who pay close attention to this stuff to be like, oh, look at them. Like, they're having this great hot streak. But I think something they need in Everything Everywhere, you know, to kind of really mm-hmm. put themselves on the map. I mean, I love what they're doing, and I think it's really exciting that there is this new company championing all this stuff and taking those risks. I just hope for them and for us that something really connects with them in the next year or so.
Well, those of us who go to Toronto know that the first day of the festival press screenings is usually when the can hits all screens. So I will look forward to finally seeing these then. I think we'll all be interested in where a lot of these films land in the fall film festival circuit. But we'll be talking about them plenty, I think.
Yeah, there's lots to talk about. It was, in looking back now, stateside, it was a pretty good year and a very interesting year with one, you know, ridiculous TV show at the center.
Well, this weekend was the Cannes Awards and also some pretty noteworthy television finales. We're in TV finale season. As we're talking, the Ted Lasso maybe series finale is still coming. But on Sunday night were the Succession and Barry finales. And not to share my champagne problems, but I was spending time with my family until I sat down on my laptop to watch the Succession finale because it was in the middle of Memorial Day weekend. David, I think you are annoyed by this also, but I think there's a reason other than our own convenience to be kind of baffled by how the new Emmy schedule is making it so Memorial Day weekend is just TV finale bonanza.
Yeah, I'm sure HBO is not thrilled about the fact that Barry and Succession ended their runs on the same night. Somebody somewhere ended its season, hopefully not its run, also on that night. They had White House Plumbers end the next day, and they have Love and Death ending the day this podcast is up. I mean, that's just an unreal amount of finales to pack into 1 week, and it's because the Emmys had a rule adjustment that we've talked a little bit about on this podcast, where if you want your finale to be eligible for the Emmys, then it needs to air before May 31st. If you're a limited series, the whole show needs to air before May 31st. So because this came up within the past year, and these networks are, you know, especially, you know, a more selective network like HBO is scheduling things, you know, years in advance, they basically had to act quickly and make sure everything was packed in before that date. And so for their spring slate, there was no room to push things weeks ahead or weeks behind because that's what they had.
The problem this is solving is the hanging episodes, right? That like there can be single episodes of a show that are eligible a year out. Like I think Stranger Things is doing one of these this year. Like there is a problem there, but maybe not as big a problem as it's creating.
Yeah, I would think that now that this is the established way of doing things, networks will be able to better schedule against it. But you still have the same problem of there's no firm date. There didn't used to be any firm date on which an eligible season or episode had to air. Mm-hmm. It used to be if you had the bulk of the episodes premiere before May 31st, you'd be fine. So the finales would sort of roll into June and maybe even July. But that now means you have to finish by May 31st. And so a lot of these shows, as we've seen with all these April, May premieres over the last few years, are going to end the last week of May, mm-hmm. which just happens to be a holiday weekend, mm-hmm. which is a disaster both for us who cover this and for people watching, because you're not going to be able to experience the, you know, most people are not going to be able to experience the glory of a Succession and Barry series finale on the same Sunday of Memorial Day weekend. It's just probably not going to happen, especially, you know, if you want to watch live and you're on the West Coast and it's in the middle of the day. It just doesn't really work. So I think it's going to require some fine tuning. And I just think it's a real shame, particularly for Barry. You know, it had such an audacious ending and it really just didn't feel like it got that moment that Succession, of course, rightly, inevitably got, because how could it compete with that, especially on the same network?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I know Twitter isn't what it used to be, but in terms of like a Succession finale, like you want to go on Twitter and watch everybody yelling about it in real time and you're just not going to get the same volume of that. I mean, I don't know, Richard and mm-hmm. Becca, if you guys were watching along live, if you like tried to engage in it or if it was impossible given the way the Sunday was placed.
Yeah, I mean, I watched Succession the night of, and I did not watch Barry the night of. So I engaged with the social media conversation around Succession. I just, you know, I think networks really believe that voters have short memories, and that's why they mm-hmm. want it to be as close to the deadline as possible so that nobody forgets a show. But I agree with David. It hurts Barry that it was so overshadowed, even if they're trying to, you know, get it in at the last possible moment. I definitely think there's going to be some strategy reassessment in the next couple of years. But again, Succession is such a unique phenomenon this year that, you know, this won't always happen. But it did definitely feel like an overwhelming Sunday. And like somebody somewhere, I love that show. And I saw like two tweets about it. And I'm like, oh, that's a show that I, you know, it's sort of more of a hidden gem that I wish more people would discover. But yeah, sometimes it feels like there should be enough room for everything. But on a Sunday like that, it does not.
Too bad. You know, is there some kind of coming like lack of content created by some sort of labor action that they maybe could have saved some of these things so there's not this crazy traffic jam?
Yeah, the problems could be very different a year from now. You're right.
Yeah, you know, it's like, gee, if we had just held one of those fucking shows, you'd have something great to play when nothing else is being made. But yeah, it's tough. I mean, it was tough for Yellow Jackets, even that they were competing time slot wise with Succession and then ended up going to Fridays. And, you know, that season, I believe, also recently ended, right? And
yeah. The fact that you don't know suggests that there was
no
a problem.
it was the same weekend, same weekend. Yeah. It had to be.
I read a spoiler and I was like, well, I'm done with that show because I don't like what they chose to do. But I think I had to prioritize Succession because obviously I do another podcast for work called Still Watching, where we had to record something that night. But it just also felt like Barry, as critically acclaimed as it is, there's just not that conversational momentum. You know, it's all an echo chamber because only a couple million people are watching any of these shows really in real time.
But, generously.
Yeah. You know, I went back to Barry on Monday night and had to do a little refresher because I'd watched the 7 episodes previous to review, you know, felt like 2 months ago. But it had its own impact. And you're right. You're all like, if it had been able to sit on its own on Sunday night, not, you know, dealing with another series finale, I think it would have resonated more. But I think my hunch would be that Emmy voters will give it its due and catch up with it when they need to, you know.
The Yellow Jackets example was interesting because, you know, we have had all of these shows airing at the same time, and it has felt like Succession has completely dominated the conversation this spring. But with Yellow Jackets, what happened this past weekend, from my observation, was the same thing that started happening with Ted Lasso a few weeks ago, which is no one was really talking about it, you know, within the certain sphere, at least, that we operate in, until everyone was like, what happened to this show? Mm-hmm. And those pieces started trickling out a lot around that Yellow Jackets finale. I also had a lot of issues with it, so I understand why those were timed to that. But it's also a question of, like, when there is so much happening at the same time, how do you allocate your coverage? How do you decide when something is worth talking about? And those were two shows. I haven't seen the Ted Lasso finale. I don't think any of us have, and it will have aired by the time this is up.
Yeah. But,
you know, in both of those cases, the story kind of became what's going on here, especially as other shows like Succession and Barry were really creatively successful this past season. So yeah, it's been a weird volume of conversation and coverage around shows that are not Succession, because there has been, I think, a sort of concerted effort among people like us, at least, to figure out when people are listening and when they're like, what they're exactly tapping into.
Yeah. And if you've got shows that are only watched by a couple million people, but we are among them and we are like talking directly to them, like if it's worth it for you to make those shows, it's worth it for you to figure out how to direct the attention around yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think we haven't figured that out yet. So we're now going to kick off our 2023 Pride flashback series. We're bringing it back from last year. Every Thursday in June, we'll be talking about a different film from Oscar history with some connection to Pride Month. And the further back we go in history, we're starting back in 1932, the more tangential these connections get for the many reasons of history. But when you go back to 1932, you get Marlene Dietrich, who is a really interesting figure in LGBTQ history. And I don't think we can be exhaustive in this conversation. We're going to talk about Shanghai Express, which is not the film that she dresses in a tuxedo and kisses a woman in, and it's not the film that got her Oscar nomination. That is Morocco, which was her first Hollywood film. It came out in 1930. It's just hard to watch. It's part of a Criterion box set that I don't own and didn't have $90 to spend. But Shanghai Express is on the Criterion Channel, or at least it will be until the end of May. Hopefully it's not already gone by the time you hear this. It is more watchable at the very least. It earned 3 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture, Best Director for Joseph von Sternberg, and Best Cinematography. I would love to know why she didn't get a Best Actress nomination for this. That this had Oscar buzz version of that history that is a little inaccessible to me, because it's such a huge star vehicle, just as I imagine Morocco is. She plays Shanghai Lily, which is, I think, even if you don't know a lot about Marlene Dietrich, that's kind of a character name that sticks with you. She's a mysterious woman on a train going through China. The film is, it's kind of this classic format of, you know, a bunch of strangers on a train, and it gets hijacked by the military rebels. And it's such a good format. It's been remade at least twice, and you can easily imagine a remake of it today. But I think as a way to get to know Marlene Dietrich and Anna May Wong, who we talked about in connection to Flower Drum Song, who we talked about around Babylon, she's in a really key supporting role in this. It's a revelation in a lot of ways. It's not as queer a film as I think Morocco is. It's kind of an expressly hetero thing about her trying to get back with the British doctor who she was in love with. But her power and her kind of allure, and as a woman in the 1930s, you know, this is right around the time of the Hays Code. So, you know, expectations around sex on film were changing a lot at this time. But the way she expresses power and sexual agency in this movie is, I think, still pretty revelatory. I had never seen it before. Is anyone else as kind of new to all of this as I was?
I'd seen clips. But first of all, what a pick. This was a delight. And there's just one shot that to me screams queer and screams absolutely should be a part of this this series. It is when the boarding housekeeper, Mrs. Haggerty, sort of walks in on Shanghai Lily, and then Anna May Wong is also in this film, and she and Marlene Dietrich have this kind of steamy, intense chemistry. She just walks in on their cart, and there's just this long silence, and they look at her, and she's taken aback, and it's kind of explosive, and it's completely quiet, and the scene progresses with her sort of discussing, you know, what she wants to do when they get off the train, and then she realizes they are not, I forget what the exact phrase she uses is, but they're not
respectable people. I wrote it down.
Respectable people. Yes. Thank you. I had it written down somewhere too, but it's just, to me, it's just, it absolutely is in conversation with who Marlene Dietrich was and what the chemistry between these women is. But there's obviously a whole bunch of that we can get into, but it was just one scene that made me smile.
There's one right before that, too, that I wrote down where a different man, I can't remember which, you know, it's one of those ensemble movies where you can't figure out who all the characters are until halfway through. And one of the other men, he tries to walk into their compartment, and they look at him. They say nothing. They have said nothing to each other the whole time. And he just walks away, like knows that he is not welcome.
Yes,
there.
Exactly.
It felt very in tune with that scene.
Stay out.
Yeah. I mean, Rebecca, you wrote kind of the tribute to Anna May Wong in our awards issue last year, kind of on the occasion of Babylon, and she was going to be on a stamp. Were you familiar with this performance before watching this movie?
She was on a coin.
Okay, excuse me. She should be on a stamp as well.
It does
not
feel
yet.
Like she's everywhere in the last 8 months or something, which I think is so cool. I had not seen the full movie. I think I had also seen clips like David, so it was I really enjoyed watching it. I think it's just so beautiful. The cinematography is really, really incredible. And it's just so rich with these lavish sets. And like Marlene Dietrich, my goodness. Like I often feel like I'm saying the phrase, you can't take your eyes off her about movies we see now. But like this is the original example of that, I feel like. She's just so confident and stunning. And it definitely sent me down the rabbit hole of sort of reading more about her, off-screen life, because I sort of knew enough, I thought, but it's just like such an interesting story and the way she lived at that time when I didn't think it would be possible to sort of be at least quasi-openly queer in her own personal life. It was really interesting. I'm glad you chose this one, Katie. I was surprised. I thought we were going with Morocco, but I'm glad you chose this one.
I wanted it to be Morocco, and then I just realized how daunting it would be to watch. And like, I want people to be able to watch this along with us too. You know, hopefully some listeners are watching these movies as well. And this one, you know, I feel like as an introduction is still pretty good.
Yeah, and both are pre-code films, which is, I think, important for the way you watch them and the tone of them and the overall characterizations.
I'm always so struck by that. I don't watch a ton of pre-code films, to be honest, but you know, I think It Happened One Night is just barely pre-code. And like the sexual innuendo, or not even innuendo, that you kind of think of old movies as being very, not chaste, but sort of very coy about that stuff. Yeah. But like in this, it's like, oh no, she's a prostitute, like, or like a courtesan, a sex worker, whatever, you know, and like they're not shy about that in a way that they would have to be just a few years later for many years, you know, until the real revolutions of the, you know, later mid-century. And I find something fascinating about that, and also a little eerie, because I think we like to distance ourselves from a lot of the problems of the past, be like, we've evolved, and it's like, no, but back then people were screwing and doing stuff, you know, like it wasn't yeah. so different. It just seems that way in a lot of media, because they had to be really careful about what they talked about and what they showed. So I liked that. And I think also speaking to that film's, I don't want to call it modernity, but sort of its difference, one of the reasons it stands out in its time, a listener, Verba, emailed us about the Chinese languages spoken in the film. And so in the region that they are in, you know, if they're going to Beijing, to Shanghai, probably Mandarin would have been more accurate. But because a lot of immigrants from China to the U.S. at the time were Cantonese and Taishanese speakers, that's mostly what's spoken. Anna May Wong is speaking Taishanese because that's where her family's from. But the Verba, our listener, she said that she was pleasantly surprised to hear actual Chinese languages spoken in the film, because she was expecting them to speak in English, like a lot of Hollywood films that take place in China, like something as recent as The Last Emperor, you know. So I think that is pretty interesting. That, and also the way that the film talks about the xenophobia and racism of its white protagonist, you know, they are not shown to be totally upstanding, but also, you know, like the movie has a really interesting relationship, problematic, sure, in certain instances, but like with that sort of dialogue around race, you know, and I don't know, it just feels strikingly modern in a way that just a few years later, films were not really allowed to be, I guess.
I was reading an article online from thatsmags.com just about Anna May Wong's role in this, and how a lot of Chinese media was kind of objected to her roles in Hollywood because, as I think we've discussed, she wasn't really given a lot of opportunities for standout roles like in this one. But that during the 30s, there was more American sympathy for China because they were struggling with Japan. As Japan, we fought in World War II, obviously. So it's interesting. It was watching this movie, I was just like, okay, where were we on China? Where was like America's idea about like what China, where China was in the global stage? Because it's changed so much over time. So I feel like I need a whole book now to understand America's attitudes toward China. You know, even though it wasn't giving Chinese actors the opportunities that they should, there was an interesting attitude toward the country as a whole.
I wish I hadn't been like so completely distracted by the actor who plays the quote unquote bad guy.
Oh, yeah.
Because his name is Werner Olund, and he's Swedish, but he's apparently made a whole career out of playing Chinese characters. And
wow.
Every time he's on screen, I was just like, nope. You know, because you see Anna May Wong, and she's like so authentic and beautiful. And then you're like, why is this Swedish man playing this role? But I know, 1932, what can we say? But.
And to have the villain, say, I'm not proud of my white blood, you know?
Yeah.
And they're like, you wish you were just Chinese? You know, it's like, why did the villain have to fucking say that?
I know,
that?
Right.
Like,
well, when he said that, when I didn't know he was going to be the bad guy, I was like, God, that's fascinating. And then, you know.
And then, no.
It goes in that way.
Very strange.
So the relationship between Marlene Dietrich and Anna May Wong is much speculated about in really interesting ways. There's just not a lot of documentation. Like, people's personal sex lives were not documented for obvious reasons. But there's a novel called Delayed Rays of a Star that came out a couple years ago. I read it a couple years ago. It was kind of not my introduction to both of them, but like I did not realize their connections here. It kind of imagines them in a kind of brief affair at this time, and then kind of watches how their lives spin out from here. It is fiction, but I think it's a really interesting way to kind of imagine more about their lives. Leni Riefenstahl is also a character. If you Google Marlene Dietrich and Anna May Wong, there is a real picture taken at a party in Berlin in 1928 of Marlene Dietrich, Anna May Wong, and Leni Riefenstahl, who at the time I think was only an actress. I don't think she'd started making movies yet. But that is a fascinating trio, and the book kind of follows the three of them over the course of the 20th century. And I recommend that in addition to all the Googling we've been doing.
I'm just imagining the clipboard or iPad person out front and people checking in. Leni Riefenstahl, R, it starts with an R. Like, it's just weird to imagine just like showbiz parties in Berlin in 1928. It's very
I think if you learn about Marlene Dietrich and how she got away with like being who she was and this personality, like you think of Cabaret, you think of like Weimar Berlin, like that she was so distinguished in that period, which is just not at all how we think of that period of time. And obviously, you know, everything that happened next.
It's also interesting that I was just reading up on Dietrich before this, like that she, you know, some German people in America during World War II had a lot of trouble. You know, they were not to the same extent as the Japanese were, certainly, but like were ostracized or whatever, suspected of collusion, you know, with the Nazis. And she really was vocal in trying to, you know, help refugees from Germany and France at the start of the war. And like, you know, she received, I think, like some sort of medal from the U.S. government for her work during that time, like, and was sort of censured by the German government for a long time because she didn't side with Germany during that war. And I guess she had a street named after her finally in 1996 in Berlin, where her birthplace was, like her childhood home or something. But like just a couple of years previous to that, they struck it down because they said, she was on the other side. You know, I don't know. It just like I didn't realize that she had had this kind of big political career in some ways, in addition to obviously her performance.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a great episode of You Must Remember This with Karina Longworth, past guest on the show, talking about her work during World War II specifically. And like she like did USO tours like Bob Hope. Like she was very staunchly like pro-American military. That's a great way to get it. And it talks about her relationship with Joseph von Sternberg a little bit as kind of prologue, which maybe we can talk about since he directed this movie. And I think 7 of her films, including The Blue Angel. That's a fascinating relationship, too.
And Rebecca mentioned the cinematography, which is really stunning here. It did win. That's the only Oscar it won. And Lee Garms, who was the DP, and he'd worked with Howard Hawks, Alfred Hitchcock. This is the only movie he'd won for. But he was nominated like 30 years later. And he also had done Morocco. So he had also worked with her before.
And one of the rabbit holes I fell down was apparently James Wong Howe did some of the background footage without credit for this film, and he goes on to become obviously one of the greatest cinematographers that we know of. But I think that was such a random aside on the cinematography.
Can we talk about Marlena's first look in The Feathers?
Oh my god! Yeah. I mean, the look.
You can talk about any look.
Yeah, where do you want to go?
I mean, that look when she gets out of this, like, she gets out of the car, right, or something. When she first shows up and she's got these feathers kind of curling around her face. It's like, and the little fascinator hat. It's just like. It's such a striking entrance, and it's, you know, even in black and white, you can tell like the sort of the vibe it's giving. You know, it's this dark kind of not menacing, but sort of sultry presence. And it's really, you know, you get why at the time she was like pretty much the biggest star in the world, you know, and was really bankable. And, you know, the Wikipedia page for this movie has some funny old ads that were targeted at theater owners, being like, it'll bring thrills, blah, 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 box office, you know, because she was such a big deal at the time. And that entrance, you're like, oh, yeah, there it is. Like, totally get it. Like, she wears that costume well. And then the character, which, you know, speaking to her not getting an acting nomination for this, like, it's such a fascinating character in this story of men and conflict and whatever, that this woman emerges as the real, you know, the sort of shrewd center of it.
But then you've also got Anna May Wong's character, who's the only one who can kill the bad guy. She like kind of steps up where nobody else can. And I don't know if that's a racialized thing where she's like this other woman who can do the dishonorable thing. But it's an interesting, powerful moment for her. And then she kind of ends the movie as like a press celebrity in a really interesting way. I mean, as with, I think, so many roles for non-white actors at that time, you're like, where is like the whole other movie about this character where you only barely sense what's going on with her?
Yeah.
It's the kind of performance that transcends the role that the movie has, you know, boxed her into, which I think just speaks more broadly to who Anna May Wong was as an actor and a star. Because, the movie is not, there are not a lot of Chinese actors in this movie. And so she does have to fill a role for what, you know, the air of the movie and for exactly what you're talking about. But because she's so compelling and at times like strange and unusual in the way she plays her, to me, it never felt like it just sort of fell into a cliche or into something sort of unwatchably problematic, say. It was always interesting because she made it interesting. And that's what actors like her had to do in movies like this.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but, you know, even after this big movie was a hit and, you know, got Oscar nominations, like, Wong still lost out on The Good Earth, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Like just a couple years later. You know, even though it's such a star turn, you know, Hollywood was not willing to turn her into that big of a star.
And this is the great thing about watching movies from, you know, this is almost 100 years old. Like, it sends you down so many rabbit holes. You see so many, like, tendrils of history kind of expanding out from this point. Or even beforehand with von Sternberg and Dietrich meeting in Berlin. You know, it's, again, why, like, that novel, Delayed Raise the Star, I was so captivated by it, because you can kind of take this one pivot point and imagine all of the different lives that spin out from there. So maybe we all now write our own versions of that novel inspired by Shanghai Express or something.
I'm going to write a really moving novel about the movie White Christmas.
I mean, I've watched it enough times. I feel like
lots of kissing with Danny Kaye and some, I don't know, male dancer.
Well, I love that we are kicking off our Pride Flashback series with this. Again, as you go back into the past, the connections get stranger. But the pre-code period, you know, I feel like we need a pre-code film expert to come on and talk to us about all the ways that there's subtext and text that, you know, those of us who came along after can't really imagine for ourselves. So I'm glad we got the chance to watch it.
Good choice, Katie.
Thank you. Congratulations to me. And next week as a preview, we're going to be jumping very far into the future, into the 80s with Kiss of the Spider-Woman. So join us for that one. And we'll see all the ways Hollywood changed in those 50 years, or maybe just talk about one movie. We'll see where the conversation goes. That does it for this week's episode. As we said, next week we'll be talking about Kiss of the Spider-Woman. Find us in the meantime at vanityfair.com. Find us on Twitter and Instagram at VF Awards Insider, and on our own. I am at Katie Rich, and Richard.
Rylaws.
And David.
David Canfield 97.
And Rebecca.
Becca M. Ford.
Our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the funniest thing to say when you're handed an Oscar goes to Rebecca Ford.
Is this a real person?
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.